Okay, so we are discussing today the development of denominations in Judaism. And the denominations, the modern denominations in Judaism, all develop in Germany, all of their roots in Germany. I apologize that we're really doing the impossible. If we could talk about the origins of German / Ashkenazic Jewry in half an hour, if we could talk about early modern German Jewish history and Moses Mendelssohn in half an hour, it's equally ridiculous that we're going to look at the development of modern denominations in Judaism in half an hour, but that's what we have available to us. And again, the idea is only to give us a context in which to understand what we will be seeing on our trip to Germany. So let's start with picking up with Moses Mendelssohn. We mentioned that Mendelssohn, in addition to being a model Jew, quote-unquote, of someone who could integrate and make it in the general world, and someone who's a proponent of spreading general culture amongst the Jews, while remaining, again, in his view, traditionally observant, Mendelssohn also is a force for the emancipation of the Jews. That is, he's an advocate for granting equality to the Jews in Germany during his lifetime, meaning the 1700s. We made mention of that in our last session. And I want to emphasize that we have here two processes taking place that are very much interconnected. We have, on the one hand, the development of the idea of equality in Europe, which is connected to the French Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. And it's reflected, for example, in the American Declaration of Independence, which is very much a product of the French Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. All men are created equal. Like that notion, which begins to spread in Europe and then makes its way across the Atlantic, is an important part of this puzzle. And the development of modern liberal thought in Europe, which includes the idea of equality for the Jews in particular. And on the other hand, the idea growing more and more amongst Jews that they should be part of the general society. Remember that in the medieval period, it wasn't only the Jews who were excluded from social and political life. It's also that they preferred, for the most part, to remain in the ghetto. So the ghetto walls are being torn down from the inside and from the outside by the early 1800s in Germany. They're being torn down by the outside, in that there are some liberal Christians who are talking about emancipating the Jews, and they're being torn down by Jews who are following Moses Mendelssohn's example. And not only following his example, but just have the desire to become more integrated and acculturated into German society. Both of these things are happening. They're both connected one to the other. In fact, in the debate on the emancipation of the Jews in France, which we, by the way, have the records of in the National Assembly in France, which is a fascinating document, in that debate, the liberals who want to grant the Jews equality in the French Revolution, the liberals themselves argue that the Jews must become Frenchmen. Now, what does that mean, Jews must become Frenchmen? It didn't mean that they had to become Catholic, like most of the rest of France. But what it meant was vague. It meant many different things, perhaps, to different Frenchmen and to different Jews. Does it mean we have to dress like Frenchmen? Does it mean we have to speak French well? Does it mean that we have to adopt French cuisine? Does it mean that we should no longer be observing kashrut and be able to eat with our Frenchmen, our French brothers and sisters? Does it mean that we stop wearing traditional Jewish clothing? Does it mean that we should be observing Sunday as a day of rest, as opposed to Saturday? What does it mean to be a Frenchman? It's never explicitly stated. But both Jews and Frenchmen have this expectation. And the same is true all over Europe, because the emancipation, the granting of civil rights to the Jews, is a process that takes about a century. It goes basically from the French Revolution, 1790s, until 1917 in Russia. I once had a history professor who said the 19th century began with the French Revolution and ended with World War I. Right? Which is a much better definition of the 19th century than 1800 to 1899, I believe. Okay, the French Revolution to World War I. And that's the period of the emancipation of the Jews. So the 19th century for European Jewry is about, in large part, there are other issues too, but in large part it's about gaining civil rights, gaining equality. And the dynamic of 19th century European Jewry to a large extent is, how can we prove that we deserve emancipation? Both before we're given it, during the debate, and then afterwards too, to prove we are indeed worthy of being considered Germans or Frenchmen or Englishmen. Okay? That's a very important dynamic, and it's so different than the dynamic that we have with the countries that we come from, where civil rights or emancipation are an assumption. Just to give you an example of this, the oldest Jewish school in England is the Jewish Free School, known as JFS in London. And JFS was founded in the mid-1800s. And when it was founded with the express mission of turning Jewish kids into English gentlemen. Today, their mission is to turn English gentlemen into Jews. And I think that speaks volumes about where we are as opposed to where they were at in the 19th century. And I urge us, when we study history, the most important thing in the study of history is empathy for the people at the time, trying to put ourselves in their shoes, and understanding that 19th century Jewry was trying to prove that they indeed deserved emancipation. They were fighting a battle that we have the luxury not to fight. And so I think that with that as background, I think that's critical to understand how the denominations developed. And so we move to 1817. The first thoroughgoing aspect of Reform Judaism to develops in Hamburg, where the Israelite Temple Association begins its work in 1817. And the Israelite Temple Association goes farther than previous, I would call them small breakaway minyanim, who wanted to have a reformed service. They develop their own sidur, and this is really the beginning of reform, of serious reform in Germany. And what we're going to be describing is classical reform. I'm not describing contemporary reform, because again, almost 200 years later, things have changed. And Eric Yaffe, the former president of the UAHC, spoke at one of the biennial conventions a few years ago. I think now it's probably already a decade ago. And he got up at the pulpit and he said, "Torah, Torah, Torah. We need more Torah in Reform Judaism." Right? That's a very far cry from classical reform. Okay? So let's look at classical reform and the Israelite Temple Association. What were the reforms that they tried to bring about? And I would say that they fall into a couple of different categories. The first is modernization. These are people who are interested in modernity. They're interested in modernism. They're interested in rationality as opposed to mysticism. And they're interested also in becoming closer to the non-Jews in their society. And And that's reflected in, first of all, the idea that they began to pray mostly in German. They eliminated most of the Hebrew from the Siddur. Again, just taking a look back, the latest Reform Siddur in America, Mishkan Tfilah, has more Hebrew than any other Reform Siddur ever printed. Right? So we're coming full circle. But here, we're talking about a move away from Hebrew. Now, the move away from Hebrew, like many of the Reforms, has both a practical and an ideological aspect. It has a practical aspect in that there were certain German Jews who were acculturated enough that they didn't know Hebrew well anymore. They couldn't understand the prayers. So why say something in mumbo jumbo that you don't understand? Right? Better to be able to express yourself in a language you understand. So that's a practical reason. But they had a strong ideological reason too. Because language and nationalism are so inextricably intertwined. During this time period, during the 19th century, to have a national language meant to be able to, if you wanted to be part of German nationalism, you had to be German-speaking. Remember that one of Martin Luther's great reforms was to move away from Latin and to pray in the vernacular. And that's exactly what the Jews are doing. They're interested in praying in the language of their country. And this goes beyond language as well. It goes to content too. They eliminate from the Siddur almost all references to Zion. Right? And we know in the traditional prayer book, the idea of the return to Zion is a very important theme that repeats itself in the Shemona Esrei. It repeats itself in many places in the Siddur. They excise them from the Siddur. And this is best expressed by a Reform rabbi in the city of Stuttgart, who upon the dedication of the new Reform temple in Stuttgart said, "Stuttgart is our Jerusalem." Now, I would even say that it's a response to the debate about emancipation in France, where the liberals, again, those who favor emancipating the Jews, say that the Jews need to recognize France as their homeland. Those who are against granting the Jews equality say, how can we grant equality to people who are praying to leave our country? And so, in the Reform movement in Germany, where emancipation has not yet happened, okay, emancipation in Germany is going to, again, we said there are about 100 different states and city-states and principalities. Emancipation is going to happen at a different time in all of these places. It'll only be finalized in 1871. It'll happen earlier in some places. So the whole emancipation debate is taking place throughout most of the 1800s in Germany. Now, if Stuttgart is our Jerusalem, then the house of worship that we're building in Stuttgart is our temple. It's not simply a synagogue. It's not simply a Beit Knesset. It is indeed our temple. Right? And if we are no longer in a diaspora, if we're no longer in a diaspora, then why do we have to observe 2 days of Yom Tov? Right? The idea of observing 1 day of Yom Tov instead of two on Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot is A, practically, it's much easier. You don't have to close your business, right, for 2 days. You can close your business for 1 day, but it's ideological as well. It's that we are home. We're not in diaspora. We're not in galut. We're not in exile. The early Reform rabbis in Germany wore a winged collar in the style of the Protestant ministers in Germany. And they adopted the mixed pew, which was the vogue in Germany at the time in the churches. They brought organs into their synagogues, or temples, better yet, in order to create a beautiful service. Because aesthetically, according to the standards of early 19th century Germany, that was part of an aesthetic service. They railed against the cacophony of voices in the Orthodox synagogues and all of the talking in the Orthodox synagogues, which, by the way, Orthodox rabbis also railed against unsuccessfully and still do today. And they wanted to have a decorous service, a service that was orderly, if you like, German.
Yeah, a little bit.
Right?
A Litvak
and
service.
But more than Litvak, Yeki, right? Something that would be orderly, something that would be respectful. This I would put not only as part of acculturation, but of modernization. You know, the typical traditional Orthodox shul, people are davening and there are different places. One person says it loud, one person says it low, one person says one sentence loud. It's a cacophony of voices. And it's very much not decorous, especially if there's a lot of talking. So this was adding order and beauty and dignity in their eyes to the service. Kara.
So I'm curious if they really wanted to be emancipated and they wanted to step in as being Germans, and this is a
yes.
I'm going to say, why didn't they just
convert?
Leave their Judaism?
Absolutely, tens of thousands of them do.
Okay.
Tens of thousands of Jews converted. We don't know the number, but it was a significant number. And it reflects that desire, that deep desire to be German. But the majority of German Jews don't want to convert. And I want to stress, those conversions are not forced. It's true, there are benefits to conversion. I mentioned Heinrich Heine in our last session, who converts in order to be able to sit for the bar exam, because as a Jew he could not. There were advantages to converting. But most German Jews, they desperately wanted to be German, but they wanted to remain Jewish. And they were searching for the way to integrate these two identities.
I just think it's really amazing. It's like very creative to react to the scenario of the fact that we need to become German, to think of how to do that.
Of how to adapt Judaism so that we can become more German. Yes, it is creative. It absolutely is creative. And of course, quite controversial as well. We'll come back to that in a moment. I didn't say it in these words, but I want to stress that one of the main things that the early Reformed Jews wanted to do was to portray themselves and call themselves Germans of the Mosaic faith. They didn't want to call themselves German Jews. And there were two reasons for this. Number one, the term... Excuse me to everybody. The term Jew was kind of an epithet. It was a word that you didn't necessarily want to have hanging over you. That's number one. Number two, traditionally, Judaism was not only a religion. Judaism was also a nationality. Right? Look in the Torah for the word for religion. You won't find it. There's B'nai Yisrael, there's Am Yisrael, right? You don't find Judaism described in Tanakh as a religion. There's only one time that the word dat is actually used to describe the Jewish people, and it's in Megillat Esther, which is the very last book of the Tanakh, and it's used by Haman. V'datehem shonot, and their religious beliefs are different. Now, it's true that, we're trying to use terms that of the modern period on the ancient period, they don't really fit. But suffice it to say that I think anyone who has any significant Jewish education understands that traditionally, Judaism was not only a belief system, and not only a halachic way of life, but it was also a brotherhood. It was also a nationality. It was a nation. We're supposed to be a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. We're supposed to be a kingdom of priests and a holy goy. A goy is a nation, a holy nation. That's what Jews are supposed to be. So the actions of the Reform movement, the early Reform movement, were very much to de-emphasize as much as possible that national element while maintaining the religious element. Hence, Germans of the Mosaic faith was the way they liked to describe themselves. There are Germans of the Lutheran faith. There are Germans of the Catholic faith. We are Germans of the Mosaic faith. Yes, David.
I haven't studied this, but my impression is that there's something new about forming a denomination, historically speaking. Like, meaning that they still claim essentially to be Jewish, but to be Jewish in a different way.
No, I don't think there's anything new about it. I think we've had many denominations, you know, groups that say we are really, we may be different, we may be doing something different than the rest of you, but we are really the true Jews. We're really the true loyal Jews. We see it in the Karaites who break away in the early medieval period, who only believe in Scripture. We see it in the Hasidic movement. It's true that this is a major break, because one of the things that the Reform movement will say is that halakha is no longer binding. And that's a very major watershed point to cross. The Hasidic movement didn't cross that, even though the Litvaks, the Misnagdim, could accuse them of that and would say, look, you're not paying attention to davening times. The halakha says you have to say Shema before a certain time, and you're ignoring that. And your shechita is somewhat different. But these were relatively minor changes. They were things that worried the Misnagdim in the 1700s in Poland and in Lithuania to make them think that they would lead the Jews away from halakha. In the end, that didn't happen. But certainly, it's a major break, but I don't think it's totally unprecedented in Jewish life to form a new denomination. The Karaites, well, that depends who you ask. The Karaites consider themselves Jewish to this day. There are still Karaites around, and they consider themselves the true Jews. I think we've talked about as much as we can speak right now about classical Reform. Two of the figures who are major figures is Rabbi Abraham Geiger. There's actually a rabbinic, the rabbinic college in Germany today is called the Abraham Geiger College. We've had Pardes graduates go there, and they've received ordination from there. That's the Reform Rabbinical College there. And also Samuel Holtheim. Samuel Holtheim is a more radical reformer than Geiger.
And they have smicha?
They have ordination. I mean, they might call it smicha, you know, but I'm translating it into English as ordination. In other words, they ordain rabbis. Okay?
Like someone who ordained, like where did they learn?
Oh, no, the chain of smicha, I think, has been lost many centuries before.
Were they rabbis, like, would, other than their philosophies and their approaches to Judaism, would the Orthodox Jewish community say that those individuals who were granting to their students, were they rabbis before?
Some were. I mean, a lot of the early Reform rabbis were, first of all, quite traditional in their practice and also quite learned. And some of their early defenses of Reform were halachically based. They were halachic treatises like you might hear a tshuva from an Orthodox rabbi in any century. So within Reform, the early Reform, there's a spectrum. Geiger is, you know, less radical. Holtheim is more radical. Holtheim, for example, is in favor of abolishing Brit Milah and in favor of moving Shabbat to Sunday. Now, both of these things are ideologically based. Moving Shabbat to Sunday is also practical. We can have the same day of rest as the rest of the people around us. We'll be less separate than the people around us. Okay? We'll be more integrated into their life if we can also have our day of rest on Sunday. Eliminating Brit Milah is, first of all, a modernization, because Brit Milah was viewed at that time as some kind of ancient practice, which was not popular in Germany, and this was a kind of modernization, ancient barbaric practice. But it's also a way of signifying the lack of difference that we hope to achieve between Jews and non-Jewish Germans, that we will no longer be distinct in the way in which we are physically, as men, having circumcision. The biggest challenge facing Reform Judaism then, and I would even argue today, is the question of the Zeitgeist. The Zeitgeist meaning the spirit of the age. And Holtheim, for example, says the following: anything which upon unbiased, careful criticism contradicts the religious consciousness of the present age has no authority for us. This is Samuel Holtheim. Anything which upon unbiased, careful criticism contradicts the religious consciousness of the present age has no authority for us. What Holtheim is saying is the Zeitgeist trumps anything else. The spirit of the age trumps anything. Tradition, halakha, whatever it might be, is trumped by the Zeitgeist. Right? Now, within the Reform movement, the more conservative elements begin to rebel against this kind of radical thought. And that brings us to Zacharia Frankel. Zacharia Frankel is the founder of what's called the Positive Historical School in Germany. And that is basically what you and I would call the conservative movement. And you ever wonder why the conservative movement is called the conservative movement? Well, relative to the more radical reforms, they are conservative. Right? They are a break from the Reform movement, not from Orthodoxy.
Didn't conservative Judaism come later?
Conservative Judaism comes later. It comes in America. Okay? There too, Reform was the most popular brand of Judaism in America when the conservative movement began in America in the late 19th century. Okay? Relative to Reform, it was conservative. Okay? And Zacharia Frankel objects to the wholesale elimination of Hebrew from the Siddur. He objects to the wholesale changes that are being made. Yes, he's in favor of Reform, but he feels Reform should come from the grassroots, not top down. He feels that it should be an organic process and shouldn't be legislated by a few rabbis sitting in a room, because, as he writes, the majority of Jews are not ready for these changes.
So he's more like Reconstructionist then?
Perhaps. I don't consider myself an expert enough on Reconstructionism to explain it that way, but perhaps. He feels that the changes should be organic, they should come out of the people, and certain things will change, but much of tradition will remain as well.
All these arguments sound very familiar.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm glad David says that all these arguments are very familiar. Absolutely. In other words, if we hear the contemporary resonating as we discuss this, it's for good reason, even though certain things have changed. Okay? But some things have not changed.
But the tensions are the same.
The tensions are definitely the same. And the challenges, in certain ways, are the same. The challenge for Orthodoxy. If I mentioned the challenge for Reform being the Zeitgeist, and to what extent will that influence us? The challenge for Orthodoxy is clearly, like, to what extent are we bound by tradition, and to what extent are we able to make change? That's essentially the challenge facing all of these movements. The challenge facing them in broader terms is, to what extent can I be a person of the age and a person of my country, and to what extent do I need to be distinctively Jewish? Okay? I want to stress, the Reform movements, even the most radical among them, were not advocating conversion. They believed in maintaining Judaism as a religion. In fact, I would go further. They believed the only way to save Judaism was by making these reforms. Because without it, what modern person would possibly imagine being part of such an ancient, barbaric, and distinct group that would set itself apart from other Germans? Last but not least, the penultimate personality that we'll come to is Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H, who comes a little bit later. He actually is a classmate for a short period of time with Abraham Geiger, who will become a very big opponent of, they'll become very big opponents of each other. But he's more of a mid-century figure. And Hirsch is the founder of what we call Neo-Orthodoxy. Today, what we would call modern Orthodoxy. And Hirsch himself studies for a time at the University of Bonn, which was very unusual for an Orthodox rabbi to get a secular higher education. He believes in secular education. He believes that Jews can acculturate to German society. He translates the Siddur, the Chumash, Tehillim into German. He writes a commentary in German. Now, some of that is utilitarian because he wants to speak to those groups that may not know Hebrew so well. But some of it is also a tacit endorsement of German. He gives his sermons in German, which was, by the way, an innovation of the Reform movement. And he does the same. He gives his sermons in German. But Hirsch believes that in order for Jews to be accepted in Germany and to take the best of German culture that can enrich their Judaism, they do not need to leave a halachic life. They can remain halachically loyal to Judaism, to traditional Jewish life, while at the same time becoming educated in the secular world and integrating more into the secular world. He writes, "I'm all for secular education, but if we have to choose between secular education and halacha, there's no question that halakha takes precedence." And his philosophy, I think, is best summed up in a line that he uses, a piece from Pirkei Avot, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, okay, which hasn't been interpreted over the centuries by many in many different ways. Hirsch's understanding was, it's beautiful to have the study of Torah together with Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz, the way of the land, the language and culture of the people with whom we live. It's beautiful to have both of those things, though clearly one of them is non-negotiable. Okay? Last but not least, I want to say that Hirsch was a very virulent opponent of reform. He may have given his sermons in German. He may have translated into German. He may have believed in secular education, but he was an outspoken opponent of reform. Last but not least, we come to the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer in Pressburg, what is today Bratislava, which is part of Slovakia today, but then was again part of the German-speaking areas. It's, at that time, it's part of the Austrian and Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Chatam Sofer represents another new denomination, Haredi Judaism. Haredi Judaism. What the New York Times calls ultra-Orthodoxy. And the Chatam Sofer says, Chadash asur min haTorah. This is based on a particular custom that we're not going to go into. About if you live in America today, sometimes they have breads in the Hashgacha. They'll mention whether it's Chadash or Yashan, right? So he uses that to say that Chadash, in his mind, innovation, change, is forbidden by the Torah. In other words, we have to stand on the ramparts and prevent any kind of change because it's a slippery slope. And even if we remain loyal to halakha, like Samson Raphael Hirsch says, but we allow for a secular education, we're going down a very dangerous path. Better that we should stay the way our ancestors did things and not innovate at all. And that is the ideological basis of Haredi Judaism, as we call it in today's world. Yes.
So was he a reaction?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. He's not the only... Look.
Was Samson Raphael Hirsch also a reaction?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But is Samson Raphael Hirsch and Zacharia Frankel, in a way, are both integrating some of the messages of reform, but filtering them in their own way. I like to view this all as a spectrum. There's the radical reformers, there's the more moderate reformers, there's Zacharia Frankel, there's Hirsch, and then there's positive historical Judaism and neo-orthodoxy, and then there is what becomes called the Haredi movement, right? Hared literally means?
Afraid,
trembling, right? Being afraid. And the Haredi understanding is... Yes, today they do. Then, I don't think that he used that term Haredi. By the way, the term Orthodox is a term invented by the Reform movement to describe their opponents. And the Orthodox initially opposed using that term, but eventually they adopt it and call themselves Orthodox.
They refer to Samson Raphael Hirsch also as Orthodox?
Yes, yes. Yes,
where
Naomi.
Where do things like the Beis Yaakov movement fit into this? Is that farther east?
Sure. The Beis Yaakov movement begins in 1917 in Krakow, in Poland, Sarah Schneer, and is actually a development that comes out of Samson Raphael Hirsch. Because Samson Raphael Hirsch established schools that taught both religious and secular subjects, and taught both boys and girls religious and secular subjects. And Sarah Schneer basically adapted that to the Polish Jewish reality. In fact, the initial people that she hired, once it started to expand, were all people from the Hirschian school systems. One of the myths about Sarah Schneer and Beis Yaakov is that it was the first schools for women that taught Jewish subjects. It's not true. They were the first Haredi schools, but there were already religious Zionist schools. There were already the Hirschian schools that were already teaching women Limudei Kodesh, Jewish religious subjects. Sarah Schneer is a great innovator, but she's an innovator in the Haredi world.
She herself was Haredi, right?
She was. She's a fascinating figure. We don't have time to talk about her now. Right. Another country, another era, early 19th century. Okay. So I think that if we can try to sum up, what we've described is a series of religious developments within Judaism that all begin in the 1800s, that go across a spectrum, and that are all essentially German. And that's what I really want to focus on as we summarize here, is that the great religious denominations, okay, excuse me, the Reconstructionists, all develop in 19th century Germany. Right? And renewal. Right. I apologize to those. Okay? But that's where the denominations develop. That, because those were the places that were at the cusp of change and of modernization. And maybe it says something about the nature of German Jewry and their creativity. That all of these movements developed there. So I think that, you know, it just should add to our anticipation of going to Germany and seeing what was not the most numerous Jewish community in the world, but in certain ways, certainly one of the most influential Jewish communities in the world, not only in terms of the many important personalities, but in terms of the religious movements that still are very important to world Jewry today in the 21st century as well. David, your question.
My question is slightly loaded, but something I thought about. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there like some sort of, there's a statement which I think is that the foundation of Reform Judaism, which is choice through knowledge or choice through something like that?
Yes, I think the idea that, you know, choice through knowledge, something like that, is a very common phrase about contemporary Reform Judaism. I'm not positive that it was also something in classical Reform Judaism. Okay. Certainly choice was, but the idea of choice through knowledge is something that I think is more modern, more contemporary. Okay? Thank you very much.